taking their place in a long true line of everyday Americans,
helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel.
Pay the bills, stay out of jail, love the neighbors and have a few good friends. Every day you are everyday Americans.
Hello there, everyday Americans. You've joined the Constitution Study and I welcome you. I'm glad you could be here today. You know, this is where we read and study the Constitution. We teach a rising generation to be free. That's a quote from Founding Father John Jay, and it's the basis for this whole program, for the work that I do, that we should read and study the Constitution and teach the rising generation to be free. We need to learn this ourselves because, well, let's face it, the government, they're not interested in teaching us everything about the Constitution. They're more than happy to teach us the parts that make them look good. But when it comes to everything else, well, they're just more than happy to leave us ignorant and apathetic. Speaking of Founding Father quotes, Thomas Jefferson had a quote that I think fits well. He says, "If you wish to be ignorant and free, you want what never was and never will be." So that's the goal. It's to dispel ignorance through education. That's the proper corrective of constitutional abuses. So today, I want to talk about this idea of state sovereignty. And really, to ask the question, are states sovereign? This has come about due to a recent rash of different laws called nullification laws. And I want to talk a little bit about the idea of nullification, but at first, we need to back up a little bit. You see, most of us were not taught in school that the states actually created the federal government, not the other way around. That actually the states rule the federal government, not the other way around. I know, we're all confused. We have this thing, what about the Supremacy Clause, Paul? What about the Supremacy Clause? Well, hang on to that for just a second. Let's start with a little bit of facts and history. The states predate the federal government. It's simple. The states were created in 1776. The federal government wasn't created until 1788, after the ratification of the Constitution by the states and the subsequent election. So the states, well, did the states create the federal government? Well, sort of. See, the Constitution starts out with "we the people." It says, "we the people ordain and establish this Constitution," but it was the states that ratified it. So we created it through our own creation called the states. And if you read the 10th Amendment, you recognize that any power not specifically delegated to the federal government in general remains with the states. So what about this Supremacy Clause? Well, you know, the federal law is supreme. Laws of the United States are supreme. Well, that's not exactly what it says. It says this Constitution and the laws of the United States made pursuant thereto are the supreme law of the land. So only federal law made pursuant, following the Constitution. I don't just mean they went through the legislative process. I mean they enact an authorized power that was authorized by the Constitution to the United States. See, when Congress passes a law that is enacting a power that is not delegated to them in the Constitution, not delegated to the United States, well, that law is void. Oh, no, that's not my opinion. That's the opinion of both Alexander Hamilton and the Supreme Court in the case Marbury versus Madison. So the first thing we have to understand is the states are sovereign over the federal government. The federal government was created to serve the states, not the other way around. Which brings me to another interesting point. And it's the general idea that which is created cannot be more powerful than its creator. If you, we think of it from, you have a child. The child is not more powerful than the parent. At least maybe until they grow up. In the same way, since the federal government is a creation through the states, it cannot be more powerful than the states. It cannot. It is irrational. It is illogical. Alexander Hamilton said in Federalist Paper No. 78 that there is no position which depends on clear principle then that the act of a delegated authority contrary to the tenor of the commission under which it is exercised is void. Now, think of it this way. The Constitution created the federal government and delegated to it certain powers. So any act of a member of the federal government that is contrary to the tenor of their commission was void. But it's not just the federal government that was created by a constitution. Our state governments were created by constitution as well. So think of it this way. If the federal government was created and it was commissioned with certain powers, is it able to act beyond those powers? Well, Alexander Hamilton went on to say that no legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than his principal, that the servant is above his master, that the representatives of the people are superior to the people themselves. The men acting by virtue of powers may do not only what their powers do not authorize, but what they forbid. So you may be asking, Paul, what does this have to do with state sovereignty? Well, first of all, the states are creations of the people. We created the states when we created constitutions. Those constitutions established those state governments and commissioned them with certain delegated powers. They then delegated some of those powers when they created the United States. We created a constitution for the United States. We created a federal government. We delegated them certain powers. The state could not delegate to the federal government a power the state did not have. This is a basic concept of construction that, you know, you cannot delegate to somebody more power than you have. The creation cannot be more powerful than its creator. And since the states are the creator of the federal government, we the people through the states created the federal government, we delegated to it its powers, the federal government logically cannot be more powerful than the states which created it. Especially when you recognize that the states not only created the federal government, they are the only ones authorized to change those delegated powers. They're the only ones authorized to amend the Constitution. Amendments can be proposed, but they're not valid until 3/4 of the states ratify it. So the states are actually superior to the federal government. The federal government was created to serve the states. Which brings us to this question, not only of state sovereignty, but of nullification. Now, this can be a touchy issue. It can be a hot-button issue. So let's start with a couple of definitions. Now, the term nullify, according to Merriam-Webster, means to make null, to make of no value or consequence. Okay, that's interesting. But I go back to the Merriam-Webster, and it says nullification is the act of nullifying, the act of making valueless. But it also says the action of a state impeding or attempting to prevent the operation and enforcement within its territory of a law of the United States. Now, this is very important. This is interesting to me and it's important. It's one of those things where the details matter. So the question is nullification the step merely where the states impede or try to prevent the operation of enforcement within the territory? Well, let's look at an example and see if this helps put it into context. There have been several states and many counties at this point that have passed some sort of nullification law or ordinance. In fact, 61% of U.S. counties now refer to themselves as Second Amendment sanctuaries. And this is often derided as being, well, it's nullification. It violates the supremacy clause of the Constitution. Well, let's stop. Let's understand that there's really, when we talk about Second Amendment sanctuaries and nullification, there's really two ways this is brought about. One is a state or a county refuses to spend their own money to enforce a law they did not create. Now, in my mind, this isn't nullification, right? So if a state says, we are not going to enforce a federal law, because we believe it's unconstitutional, that we are not going to spend our funds to enforce a federal law, that is not nullification. At least not, I think, in the strictest sense of the terms. It's merely a state saying, wait a second, we, as one of the parties to this compact, that is the Constitution, We look at what our creation is doing. We think they've gone beyond the pale, and we are not going to fund it. This is no different than when the Congress says, you know, they're not going to fund a program or something that the federal government does, or the president signs an executive order, and the Congress says, yeah, that's fine, but we're not going to give you any money. This is not nullification, because they're not saying that the federal law enforcement cannot enforce that law within our boundaries. It's saying we are not going to enforce your law within our boundaries. So to me, this is at best nullification light. It's not true nullification. They're not saying the law is null and void. They simply say, we're not going to participate. So is this a violation of the Supremacy Clause? Well, the Supremacy Clause, which is Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution, says, this Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land. Now, it also says, and all treaties made which shall be made under the authority of the United States. We're focusing on laws at the moment. I'll deal with treaties probably on another day. So here's the question. If the Constitution says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and a state says, well, shall not be infringed means shall not be infringed, so if the federal government passes a law, if Congress passes a law, if the president issues an executive order that infringes on the right of the people to keep and bear arms, is it nullification for them to say, we won't help? No. Is it a violation of the Supremacy Clause? No, because the state is saying, look, we who created the United States, we who are the parties to the compact, meaning we, the states, as the parties, are the only ones able to legitimately define what that compact means. We've looked at this and said, you are not, this law was not made pursuant to the Constitution. This executive order was not issued pursuant to the Constitution. Therefore, it is not the supreme law of the land. Therefore, we don't need to help. And the Supreme Court agrees. The Supreme Court has already opined that the federal government cannot force the state to spend money to enforce federal law. Now, again, this is not, this in my view, based on the dictionary definition of nullification, is not nullification. This is not the state saying this law is null and void, which is why I find these, you know, these euphemisms, you know, Second Amendment sanctuaries and all that. This is political, you know, linguistics to try and make it sound bigger than it really is. Now, there have been states that have actually tried to nullify federal law. I like to pick on Kansas back in 2003. See, Kansas passed their own Second Amendment Protection Act. I forget what they actually called it. It was passed by the legislature. It was signed by then Governor Brownback. He had a big press conference and he made a big speech about how, you know, Kansas is going to protect the Constitution and the Second Amendment. And if anybody from a federal agency tries to enforce unconstitutional gun laws, laws that violate the Second Amendment, they would be arrested and tried within the state of Kansas. That, my friends, is nullification. That is a state attempting to nullify a federal law to make it meaningless. You can't enforce it within our borders. Now, there are two very important things to recognize. First, as soon as ATF showed up to enforce the National Firearms Act in Kansas, Kansas folded like a cheap suit. The governor, the attorney general, the Congress, the legislature, I should say, they did nothing to protect their citizens when the feds actually showed up. So this was, you know, Kansas was a paper tiger, which is one of the reasons why when these states actually pass these nullification laws, I always wait and see, are they going to put their money where their mouth is? Are they going to walk the walk, or are they just going to talk the talk? But here's the other thing. See, right now, Kansas is one of 50 signatories to the compact that is the Constitution. So does that mean that one state can nullify the law of the United States? Well, legally, no. They can look at it and say, listen, this is not part of the agreement that we made. You've gone too far. This is not a power we delegated to you. We will not enforce it. Now, when a majority of the states start saying, United States, Washington, D.C., you've gone too far. You've overstepped your boundaries. Now you have a rationale for nullification. Now you have the creators of the federal government putting it back in its place. This is what we need to learn to do. If you're going to ask the federal government to rein in its own power, you're asking what's not going to happen. It is extremely rare for someone to voluntarily give up power. In fact, when George Washington refused to serve a third term, I believe it was the King of England, remarked that he truly was a great man to voluntarily give up power. President Washington could have been our first dictator, and he refused. He voluntarily gave it up. That's why this idea of checks and balances isn't just between the three branches of government, but the states are supposed to act as a check on their creation. See, the Constitution, it's ink on parchment. It's not going to get up and dope slap the president for signing an invalid executive order. It's not going to run through Congress and arrest everybody who's violating it. It's ink on parchment. It's the people and our states that are to keep the federal government in control. So yes, states are sovereign. They created the federal government, therefore they rule over the federal government. And while I've picked on Second Amendment sanctuary movement so far, that's only one of many examples of states saying, we're not going to do this anymore. And it's interesting because a lot of this started with the marijuana movement, with states saying, we're going to legalize marijuana within the state, even though the federal government says it's illegal. But how could states do that, Paul? How could they ignore an FDA rule? Because the Constitution doesn't delegate to the United States the power to regulate drugs. The FDA is illegal. The states never gave the federal government the power to determine what drugs would be allowed and under what circumstances. So that's where it started. And now, like I said, we're seeing more and more states, more and more counties saying, we will not enforce laws that violate the Constitution. This is not a violation of the Supremacy Clause. This is not insurrection. This is not civil disobedience. This is noncompliance with laws that are void. As Alexander Hamilton said, and as the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison said, laws repugnant to the Constitution are void. Why should a state enforce a law which is void? See, and this is why I believe John Jay recognized it was so important that we ourselves, we the people, read and study the Constitution of this nation. That we recognize what our rights are, that we know what our rights are. We know what our state's rights are. Because when a state is enacting its own rights, well, the state is a creation of the people. That's the people exercising their rights through the state. It's one of the reasons why the 17th Amendment was so damaging to the Republic. You see, when the Congress was formed in 1788, when it was created under the Constitution, that was ratified in 1787, they said, okay, we're going to have two houses, and the House of Representatives is elected by the people, and the Senate is elected by the states. So each state legislature appointed their two senators. And if you stop and think about it, that kind of makes a lot of sense. Because that means all federal legislation has to be reviewed by the representatives of the people and the representatives of the states. The states had a say in federal law. If the people wanted to pass a law that violated the sovereignty of the states, the representative of the states could stop it. They could refuse to pass it. It also helps explain why, while it's the representatives of the people that must initiate any legislation involving collecting revenue, and it's the representative of the people that are the only ones allowed to impeach a member of the federal government. It is the Senate, the representative of the states, that try those impeachments, that have to advise and consent on appointments for judges and cabinet members and ambassadors. It's the states' representatives. It's the states' representatives that approve treaties with foreign countries. This is what we're not taught in school, or one of the many things we're not taught in school. But with the 17th Amendment, when we came to the popular election of senators, we basically turned the Senate into another House of Representatives. See, while it's the job of the Senate to represent the states have no say in who represents them. And it's interesting, if you look at the growth in the size and scope of the federal government, there are several inflection points. There are several points where the growth rate increases dramatically. One of them is 1913. Part of the reason is because now the states have no control, no input on federal legislation anymore. The second is with the authorization of the federal income tax, the states no longer have a say in the funding of the federal government. See, before 1913, the federal government couldn't tax you directly. They had to tax you through the state. And in 1 year, two amendments, the states gave up their control of the purse of the federal government and of federal legislation. That's why states act and state government members act, you know, believe they are subjects to the federal government, that they must do what the federal government says, forgetting that they tell the federal government what it can do, not the other way around. It's education is how we deal with this. It's one of the reasons why I do what I do, is to help you not only educate yourself, educate your neighbors, educate your state government. Explain to your representative, your governor, what the Constitution actually says, that the states created the federal government when they ratified the Constitution, that the states are the only ones able to add more powers to the federal government. Therefore, when the federal government goes beyond its delegated powers, it's the responsibility of the states to bring it back under control. Now, one of the ways we deal with is nullification, or in some cases, simply the refusal to enforce or unconstitutional, therefore void, laws. Education is the answer. So I hope you do a couple things before I head off the break. I want to remind you, please head to constitutionstudy.com and read some of the articles, watch the videos, look at what I'm talking about when it comes to understanding what the Constitution says. Now, lawyers and judges disagree with me all the time. I really don't care, because I've asked lawyers for years, when they were in law school, did they study the Constitution or constitutional law? And in the several years I've been doing this, only one has ever said that they actually studied the Constitution in law school. Everyone else says they study constitutional law, which is the opinion of judges euphemistically called constitutional law. But when the people understand, when we look at these governors and these county mayors and other officials, and they are standing up for your rights by recognizing the limitations placed on the federal government, see, it's not enough to simply say, goody. We should really talk to them and support them. So if you're in a state that has passed some sort of Second Amendment Protection Act, Sanctuary Act, Protection Act, anything, well, contact your governor. Contact your state rep, your state assemblyman, your state senator, whatever they're called in your state. Help them to understand that that was a good move, that you'll support them for that, not simply with your vote, but with your deeds. Ask them, how can you support them in making sure that this bill, this legislation, this move continues, that it doesn't get bulldozed by those who believe that the federal government can do whatever Congress says it can do. See, that's what education does, is it makes you, it gives you the tools you need to defend your rights and to support those who are trying to defend your rights as well. As we head out to break, I want to remind you that please head to healthycell.com/outloud. See, as an Out Loud listener, you get 20% off your first order from healthycell.com, where you can find this new technology vitamins. Not the pills that they haven't done anything with since the 1930s, but a simple, easy-to-use, travel-ready gel pack. You can set up a subscription so that they come every month, make your life easier, and save a little extra money while you're doing that. Try the Focus and Recall. If you're studying a document like the Constitution, you want to make sure you're paying attention, that you're really focusing on what you're doing. And if you're like me, you get kind of the end of the day and the mind tends to wander. So give it a try. Try the Focus and Recall to really focus your mind back on what you're doing. Forget the energy drinks or the energy shots. Try a simple vitamin supplement that will help you get through the end of the day. Focus on what you're working on. And help you remember what it is you're doing. And again, healthycell.com/outloud, you get 20% off your first order, and I doubt it will be your last.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
AmericaOutloud.com. Simply put, we're patriots who believe in Ronald Reagan's vision of a shining city on a hill. From sea to shining sea, you can listen in on iHeartRadio. Our free apps are on Apple, Android, or Alexa, or our world-class media player. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. We're talking state sovereignty today. The understanding that the states created the federal government, the state set the boundary for the federal government, that we, the people, ordained and established this constitution through our states. That the states are the only entities empowered to tell the federal government what it can do, and that the federal government has no power outside of that delegated by the states. And we were talking about this, the Second Amendment sanctuary movement. We've been talking about other examples of what some people refer to as nullification. There's actually very few examples of nullification that I've seen. Most of them are generally the states or, in some cases, counties, simply saying, we will not participate. You pass an unconstitutional law, we're not going to help. You're not going to spend our money, you're not going to use our people to violate the Constitution of the United States. That is not nullification, and that is not a violation of the Supremacy Clause. We discussed all that in the first half. So I want to look at a couple of other examples. Because I mentioned, you know, the marijuana legalization was one of the first examples of this. Then we had the immigration sanctuary cities. That one's actually very interesting because I wonder how many of you realize that immigration is not a power delegated to the United States. Oh, yeah, we all assume that immigration is a federal power, but it's not. Congress is allowed to set standards for naturalization, not immigration. Immigration is still a state issue. Now, should it be a federal issue? That's another question. You know, that could certainly be debated. But legally, it's still a state issue. So we had the marijuana legalization, we had immigration sanctuaries, now we've got the Second Amendment sanctuaries, and now, in 2021, we're seeing a lot of other pushback. For example, South Carolina governor has blocked the Biden administration from bringing unaccompanied children from the border into their state. Again, immigration is a state issue, not a federal one. So when the federal government decides that they're going to let people into this country in violation of the law, and then expect the states to take care of them, well, South Carolina, and I believe several others have said, no, we don't think so. We don't think so. We did not give you the authority to tell us to take care of your mess. This is one of several examples of states saying, no, we're not going to comply. And the other one I'm seeing more and more of are states sending their own National Guard to the southern border to help deal with this problem. Now, they're doing it because the federal government isn't. And again, the question is, does the federal government have the legal authority to do that? Yes, the federal government is supposed to protect the states against invasion, but immigration in general, that's a whole nother issue. But when the federal government won't do its job, it's up to the states. Why? Because the states created the federal government. If their creation is going to misbehave, it's up to them to do something about it. So when a state like South Carolina or any other says, no, I'm sorry, Mr. President, I'm sorry, Washington, D.C., you are not authorized to invade our state simply because you need a place to put these kids. That is not a power delegated to the United States. Therefore, that is a power that generally remains with the states. Remember, 10th Amendment. If a power is not specifically delegated to the United States, nor prohibited to the states, then it remains with the states, respectively, or to the people. Again, this is not nullification. This is not the state of South Carolina trying to say that federal law is null and void. It's saying, we're not participating. We are not going to spend our resources to deal with a federal law that was not legally created. It is not within the commission of the United States. Therefore, it is not a valid law. Now, Oregon has an interesting history with this. See, way back in 1987, they passed what they refer to as a sanctuary state law that prohibits state and local law enforcement agents in Oregon from using agency money, equipment, or personnel for the purpose of detecting or apprehending persons whose only violation of the law is that they are persons of foreign citizenship present in the United States in violation of federal immigration law. Now, this was referred to as an anti-commandeering law. And the idea is that the federal government cannot commandeer state and local resources to enforce federal law. And this has been upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, now a group in that state has expanded this, or they've proposed a bill that would expand this, and it would prohibit state and local agencies from collecting information about a person's citizenship status. Now, this to me is an interesting dilemma. Right? On the one hand, I kind of like it when states poke their fingers in the federal government's eye. But on the other hand, is the lack of willingness to collect this information actually damaging to the state itself? In other words, does the state of Oregon have an interest in knowing whether or not people are in the state or in the country, much less in the state, legally? Now, this all revolves around a federal law called Title 8 U.S. Code Section 1373, which says, quote, notwithstanding any other provision of federal, state, or local law, a federal, state, or local government entity or official may not prohibit or in any way restrict any government entity or official from sending to or receiving from the Immigration and Naturalization Service information regarding the citizenship or immigration status, lawful or unlawful, of any individual. In other words, this is the federal government trying to tell the states that you must tell us If you're a state or local entity, you must tell us. You may not prohibit, you may not restrict a government entity from telling them about it, telling the federal government about it, the INS. Well, again, is this a power delegated to the United States? No. So I'm very happy for Oregon to stick their finger in the eye of the federal government and saying, no, we aren't going to do that because you have no legal authority to demand that we do so. We created you, sir, not the other way around. Or to paraphrase, I believe, is a Bill Cosby quote, I mean, you know, I could take you out and make another one just like you. The states control the actions of the federal government. So when the federal government gets too big for its britches, it's time for the state to stand up. Now, again, I also look at it and say, is that really the best move for Oregon? Is it within Oregon's best interest to not collect that data? I'm not talking about forwarding it on to the United States. But I could certainly see where state and local agencies would want information about a person's citizenship status. For example, if someone comes and, tries to register to vote, or tries to get a driver's license or other form of ID. Just a few examples where the state would want to know, are you a citizen? Are you a legal resident? But I have no problem with them saying, no, that information is not to be sent to the federal government. They have no need. They have no legal authority to demand that. So that to me is an interesting standoff. See, that is a scenario where the state is actually trying to nullify a law. Because, again, 8 U.S.C. 1373 says you cannot prohibit government entities from sending us this information. And the state of Oregon says, oh, yes, we can. You have no legal authority to demand it. And what's interesting is I'm kind of looking to see how this progresses, because this latest update is relatively new, the House Bill 3265. Because I'm curious to see, you know, with President Biden's executive orders and other pushback, I'm curious to see where this goes. And so one of these days, I believe this is going to be sent to the courts. And I really don't care. I mean, the courts will offer an opinion, but that doesn't make it law. Now, most of our states don't understand that because most of our states are run by lawyers, and lawyers were not taught the Constitution in law school. They don't recognize that courts have neither force nor will, only judgment, that courts offer opinions, not rulings. But I suppose that's a discussion again for another day. But again, I think it's interesting when state and local officials, do they want to not collect this data, or do they simply not want to send it to the federal government? And if you think that states should be forced to send information to the federal government regarding immigration, well, then we need a constitutional amendment to make it legal. We need to place immigration legally in the hands of the United States, not illegally as it's currently done. Again, if you wish to be ignorant and free, you want what never was and never will be. It's a simple solution. We just have to do the work. Now, the state of New York, my old home state, the Empire, coming out of Albany, I used to live not far from there. There's been a bill filed in the New York State Assembly that wants to limit warrantless drone spying and, as I say, hinder the federal surveillance state. I love these. So an Assemblyman Ron Kim introduced a bill, Assembly Bill 3311. The Protect Our Privacy Act. I always love the titles of these. It's like, oh, we'll make them sound good because no one will actually read what's going on inside. But let's take a quick look. So basically, A3311 bans the use by law enforcement of drones at concerts, protests, demonstrations, or other actions protected by the First Amendment. Well, I hate to tell you this, Albany, but those actions are protected by the First Amendment from federal intervention. So not state intervention, but I understand their point. You know, they believe the First Amendment applies to the states, even though it says Congress shall make no law. I know I did something weird. I read the Constitution. But again, those those concerts, protests, demonstrations, they would be protected from federal intervention by the First Amendment. So I don't have a legal problem with it. I just think it's a misunderstanding of the Constitution, but it's not a problem. So they're saying law enforcement, they can't surveil you when you're at some sort of outside event that would be protected by the First Amendment. Cool. It also prohibits police from using drones equipped with facial recognition software or using facial recognition on video or images obtained or created by a drone. So the idea is you're not going to have Big Brother, or at least law enforcement, flying drones around to collect information on you, to search information about, to search and collect without a warrant. Now, I actually did an article about this a while back where a town used a drone to search the property of someone they believed was violating a zoning ordinance. And that got shot down, no pun intended. That got shot down by the courts. But it's, again, it's this is a state saying, you know what? You know, just because you're out in public doesn't mean that a search is reasonable. That's the Fourth Amendment requirement, right? Fourth Amendment, you're protected against unreasonable search and seizures. And it's not reasonable that essentially going out about your business, that attending an outdoor protest or demonstration or concert or anything, any other legal outdoor activity, is it reasonable for them to be searching for you? But this has an impact on federal actions as well. See, while the law would apply to state and local drone use, there is an interesting impact. See, most of the tools they use to collect this data, well, it comes from federal funding. Yeah, see, those state and local drones often come from funding from the federal government, something the federal government cannot legally do, but it's a bribe that they hand out all the time. We see this all the time. This should be nothing new. But when I read this a little farther, I found something very interesting. See, according to a report by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, these drones do more than simply capture high-quality video and stills. They can be equipped to intercept cell phone calls, determine GPS location, gather license plate information. They can determine whether or not an individual is carrying a gun. They can identify changes in the landscape. They can track footprints or tire tracks. Some, as I said, are even equipped with facial recognition. This is Big Brother's eye in the sky. Now, why is this important? Why is the federal government giving money to the states to gather all of this data? Well, very simply, the federal government agencies, use that information. It's a way to get around certain limitations. See, they have this thing called the information sharing environment. So what they do is, I said here, you know, state of New York, city of New York, we'll give you a boatload of money. You can buy yourself some drones, all this fancy tech, and then you can go out and fly this data. All you got to do is let us look at it. Give us access to it. Let us search it if we want. Now, I don't know about you. I don't find that a reasonable search. If I'm being tracked every time I'm outside so that the government can search for it at their convenience, that's not reasonable. So while I have a lot to complain about in the Empire State, I like this law. If law enforcement or any government entity wants to use a drone to collect information, well, then they need a warrant. And that warrant must be supported by probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describe what is to be searched and who or what is to be seized. It's called the Constitution, folks. It's called the supreme law of the land, folks. And Big Brother in Washington, D.C. is not legally allowed to get around it by getting the states to do their dirty work for them. I'd love to see a lot more states pass laws like this, not simply to prevent the feds from getting it, but hey, how about we just abide by the Fourth Amendment? If you want to gather data on someone, if you want to search, if you want to seize data about them, you need a warrant, and it must meet that standard criteria. But again, since most of us are ignorant, we do not know the law, we do not know what our rights are, we don't recognize when these states are violating them, and we have no clue how to defend ourselves from them, or how to defend our rights, or how to assert them. And now we got another one. This is coming out of Maine. There's a bill sent to the governor that would require a conviction before asset forfeiture, but it also opts out of a state of a federal program. Now, a civil asset forfeiture is a disgusting, tyrannical abuse of power. The idea of civil asset forfeiture is that if the government believes that an asset was either used to commit a crime or is the profit from a crime, they can you forfeit your ownership rights. Now, they don't have to prove it. You know, you're guilty until proven innocent. And if you go to the website, constitutionstudy.com, and you search for civil asset forfeiture, I've done several articles and videos about the abuse of this power. You know, was it one where I think it was the state of New York versus $135,000? That's actually a court case. And they come with some incredibly twisted language to do this. You know, the lawyers really make their money when they twist the English language to claim that, well, no, we're not taking your money. We're seizing the money. We're charging the money. Imagine, right? The government confiscates thousands and thousands, I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And rather than saying, well, we took your money. No. We charged the money. We didn't charge you with anything. We charged the money. Money's an inanimate object. Imagine you're driving somewhere and you get pulled over. I don't know, speeding ticket, a taillight that was out, and an officer sees a large quantity of cash. They simply assume that it was an ill-gotten gain, and they say you forfeit your rights to it. No trial, no charge, no nothing. This is criminal on a scale unheard of in recent history. I mean, this is truly a criminal government that does this. And states have started pushing back. And again, the latest is the state of Maine. It's gone through the legislature. I don't know if it's been signed by the governor yet or not. But it basically says, listen, before you can use asset forfeiture, and understand why we have asset forfeiture. I think it was back in the 80s. It's like, with all the drug crimes and all the cartels, it's like, we have to take the money away from the cartels. I know they'll forfeit their goodies. Right. So if they're using a $2 million boat to transport drugs into the country, they forfeit the boat. If you find a drug dealer, you know, with a nice car and a boatload of cash, they forfeit that. And the idea was it was supposed to be a punishment for crime. Well, the problem is we kind of forgot that little, you know, Sixth Amendment and the right to a trial by jury and be able to confront your accuser and all that. And it went from being simply an additional punishment to a punishment before trial. And when I talk about the parties, and I talk about a pox on both their houses, remember, this was supported and enlarged under Republican administrations. In fact, Attorney General Jeff Sessions was a huge promoter of asset forfeiture. So what has Maine done? They said, basically, Maine does two things. One is, before you can claim that a criminal has forfeited an ill-gotten gain, there must be a conviction. You cannot forfeit. You cannot claim a forfeiture of assets unless there's a conviction. Once they've been convicted of a crime, then you can look at seizing their assets. Basically, they call it asset forfeiture. What it is seizing. It's stealing. It's taking money. So, all right, first you got to have a conviction. This is good. Here's the dirty little secret, though. There's a federal asset forfeiture program. And what a lot of states that have done, a lot of law enforcement agencies, because law enforcement agencies make money from this. They get a percentage of the assets they seize. A little bit of a conflict of interest, isn't there? Say we're going to seize money because we're going to get a cut. Well, these states that said, no, we're not going to allow asset forfeiture. We're going to require a conviction. Well, what these state entities have done, they said, well, we'll turn this over to the feds. We'll make it a federal case, violation of the Constitution. Problem number one, most federal crimes are actually not federal crimes because the federal government has no authority to make laws that make those things a crime. But what the feds do is they say, fine, turn it over to us and we will give you a portion of the assets that we've seized. Again, talk about a conflict of interest. Imagine, you know, you're some high up muckety muck in a police department or a sheriff's office, and you see a guy, he's got a $5 million house, and he's got a whole boatload of cars and a couple of big boats, and I mean, you're just seeing dollar signs, but your state says you can't collect them. Oh, well, I'll just turn them over to the feds, and the feds will give me a cut. That's what asset forfeiture is. It truly is governmental theft, and Maine was one of the few states I've seen smart enough to say, not only will we not participate, we are going to prohibit our state and local law enforcement agencies from using the federal program. I'm glad to see this. This is another state saying, you know what? We're just not going to participate. If you want to steal, if you want to violate the Constitution, step one is, we're not going to participate. See, that's what a sovereign state does. A sovereign state starts by saying, we will not participate. We think this is wrong. This is unconstitutional. It's a violation of the law. We will not comply. Then it gets together with its neighbors and say, really? Did we authorize this? Did we say this was okay? No? Well, then why are we allowing it to happen? Let's nullify it. Let's forbid it being enforced in our states. Not, we won't comply, but we will forbid it. We will actually arrest someone who attempts to enforce this law. What Kansas talked about doing back in 2003. See, this is how states regain control of the federal government, put it back in its place. Sure, if one state comes out and says, listen, we're not going to comply, we're going to nullify this, we're going to arrest anybody, and nobody joins them, they're outstanding in the field all alone. As Benjamin Franklin said after the signing of the Declaration, we must all hang together, or assuredly we will all hang separately. So when the states act alone, try to do this, they're the target. But when we simply say, no, you cannot force me to comply, then we turn around and get a bunch of our neighboring states, our fellow parties to this compact, and say, we did not authorize this. You are not allowed to. No. That's nullification. And that, my friends, is legal. As long as the nullification involves a power that the United States has assumed without being delegated by the Constitution. I would love to see states say, you know what, the Department of Education is unconstitutional. We don't authorize it. Therefore, anybody who tries to enforce a DOE regulation in this state will be arrested. Anybody who accepts bribe money from the DOE will be arrested. I'd love to see that. Department of Education? How about Department of Energy? We can throw that one in too. Yeah, Department of Energy, or the EPA, or the FDA, or the USDA, or any other of the myriad agencies that do not have constitutional authorization. They are illegal. They are criminal. And the only way it's going to stop is when the people of this country, when we the people refuse to comply, when we demand that our states not only refuse to comply, but to protect us from these illegal actions of the federal government. We demand that our sheriffs, the locally elected chief law enforcement officer of the county, demand that he or she protect us from the illegal acts of the federal government. Only then will the federal government be put back in its place. And only then will America once again be the land of the free. Because as long as we sit back and let the federal government do whatever it wants, we are not its masters. We are its subjects. Now, the difference between being a subject and being a master starts in your head. It starts with education. It starts with knowing what the Constitution says, what our founding fathers meant, by recognizing the tools and the powers that we have to defend ourselves against this out-of-control federal government, and in many cases, out-of-control state governments as well. See, education is the true corrective of constitutional abuses. And contrary to what you've been told, it's not that hard. You can read the Constitution in 30 minutes. In fact, I have a book called Read the Constitution in 30 Days because most people don't believe me when I say you can read it in 30 minutes. You want a great start? There you go. It's, you know, two and a half minutes a day, and in 30 days you've read the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. That's available on constitutionstudy.com. In fact, if you sign up for the newsletter up there at constitutionstudy.com, I'll give you a digital copy of that book free. You don't even have to buy it. Just sign up for the newsletter. I'll give you a copy. You can download it right away and start reading. I've got other tools. I've got the Constitution Scholars where we read and study. I have books on the 16th and 17th Amendment. I have a book that where we study the entire Constitution in plain, simple English, just to make it easier for you. All that's available. Check out ConstitutionScholars.com and ConstitutionStudy.com. This is how we the people regain control of our federal government and our state governments as well. It's up to us. No one's going to do it for us. The Constitution isn't going to be like some Marvel superhero that jumps out with a cape and protects us all. We have to do it ourselves. And it starts today. So do me a favor. Be sure to make AmericaOutloud.com your daily stop for all the latest news, happenings. Do your part. Share the stories. Share the articles. Share the videos. Make sure that we help secure America's future of liberty.
Stay out of jail, love the neighbors, and have a few good friends.